Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Anthony Johnson, and I want to welcome you to this edition of the Anthony Johnson Show. We live in a society where it's common practice for black men, women, children, and other persons of color to be murdered by police. Other African Americans and non-Americans, they committed no crimes, no acts of violence. The crime, though, was of being African American or a person of color. From 1865 to 1948, lynching in America and the lynching of black people in this country was a celebratory event. That's why you hear words like picnic. That's how that word actually got started in America. So for example, white pastors would end church services early to allow families to go home to pack picnic baskets of sandwiches, snacks, and beverages, and then find a good spot on the grass to view the legacy of the murdered individual. So it was one of these situations where people talk about these so-called really bad individuals. We start making people out to be not even human. We talk about the church. We talk about people being good Christians, and we know that many of the wars since humans started walking the earth have been fought over Christian ideology or religious ideology. But here in America, it took on another dynamic. Spectators at these lynchings would yell enthusiastically when the victim had their fingers, toes cut off and tossed into the crowd, their eyes gouged, genitals cut off. All the while, the victim was alive, was set ablaze. This is America. We hadn't seen anything like that in the world since the Dark Ages. But this was happening from 1865 to 1948. Now, what some people will say, well, Anthony, those individuals that were lynched, although wrong, we don't subscribe to it, but they didn't really have jails back then. Actually, they did. But their crimes must have been so horrific that the community just couldn't embrace these individuals just going to jail for the rest of their life or going through the proper channels of the judicial system of being found guilty. So that's normally what the consensus is. This is what people buy into. But during that time, 70% of those African Americans that were lynched, burned, and all the other horrific things that was happening to them, they were innocent. They were casualties of mob law, of a crime that they were accused of doing that they didn't do. Shockingly, some of the individuals, some of the victims did have a day in court, were found not guilty by a white jury, but were still lynched to satisfy the unquenchable bloodthirst of American terrorists / racists from all walks. So even when those few African Americans were aboard the trial, went through the legal process and was found innocent, not guilty, mob rule still reigned supreme. During President Franklin Roosevelt's unprecedented 3 terms, he was asked multiple times by African American groups, including the NAACP, to create an anti-lynching law. But he repeatedly failed to do so because, as he told some members of the NAACP, that they had 2 choices: get the New Deal and programs that was going to also benefit African Americans, but you didn't. That it would benefit also African Americans and not every other American, or the Southern Dixiecrats wouldn't support it. So he would not go through with trying to put together an anti-lynching law. So he kept quiet as black people in the South, East, and West were lynched with perfect regularity. See, one of the things sadly was not taught in our schools, in our history classes, ladies and gentlemen, is that we know the majority of the people, African Americans, were being lynched in the South. That's where, you know, you didn't go. But they were also lynching in New York. There were lynchings in California. There were lynchings in New York. New York. There were lynchings here in Philadelphia. There were lynchings in Minnesota. So even to this very day, you have a lot of the Southerners say, you know, the South is always criticized for their lynching, rightfully so, you know, because they did the most lynching. But they do have citizens or representatives from the South have a valid point when they say it wasn't just the South. The North was doing it. The West was doing it as well. So everybody played a role in this. And you got to understand something. Although by 1948, the last public lynching was held. That's where, as I stated previously, there was no more, we're going to lynch this black person or we're going to lynch these black people. Come on out. You know, leave church early. Come on down. You know, bring your picnic baskets. And, you know, as Yogi Berra used to say, his picnic baskets. And come in and watch this, you know, come watch the festivities. By 1948, you had to do it in the dark now. So they would still lynch you. They just didn't make it public. And during those times, more than 97% of the people that engaged in these violent acts never saw a day in prison. Even when the federal government had the power back then to bring them to justice, they would say, we don't get involved with state affairs. That's a state issue. So the state has to handle that. So you think the state, they say in Mississippi or Alabama, who is the governor is a member of the Klan, whose city council members and senators are members of the Klan or just white racists, you think that they're going to prosecute themselves? So for decades, the federal government was basically a useless entity in this country. So, and by the 1960s, at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, there was still a surge in the murder and lynchings of unarmed and innocent African Americans by police and non-law enforcement white citizens. So even during the course of the Civil Rights Movement, lynchings was taking place. It was a surge. Some in the federal government said, we're seeing the type of lynchings now during the Civil Rights Movement that we were seeing during Reconstruction in this country, where some African-American, whether it was man, woman, or child, was being murdered and lynched every day. So depending on one's level of understanding and awareness about the plight of black and brown people in this country, one might argue that they are better off today than they were 50 years ago, or 60 years ago, or 70 years ago, especially when one remembers Jim Crow, an era during which black people were ruthlessly brutalized, particularly by white supremacist groups such as the Ku Klux Klan. So people will look at you today and say, and have said to me, well, Anthony, no, you're right. You know, someone who loves history and studied history, and particularly history of African Americans, yeah, those were horrific times, terrible times. But times of, you know, this is the 21st century. You know, we don't do stuff like that anymore. And I just have that look on my face as if to say, yeah, really? And I do really mean, yeah, really. Because you and I both know that is not true. It is happening. It's happening on a daily basis in this country. However, if one constructively analyzed the accomplishment gap between students of color and their white counterparts, the decline in income, and other forms of educational and socioeconomic inequality that black people, particularly poor students of color, have been experiencing over the last several decades, one would realize that substantially, nothing has really changed. See, murdering innocent black people, murdering and lynching people of color in this country, we basically know where it started. The question is, where did the power come from where people could go out and systematically just kill individuals without no consequences? Well, it's because of structural racism. See, structural racism, ladies and gentlemen, operates at the societal level and is the power used by the dominant groups to provide members of the group with advantages while disadvantaging the non-dominant group. The dominant group uses structural racism not only to obtain resources such as employment or wages, but also to limit the non-dominant group's access to these resources. So during the Jim Crow era, for example, structural racism sponsored by the federal and state governments explicitly created advantages for white people and disadvantages for African Americans and other people of color. Structural racism still exists long after the Jim Crow era, which significantly disadvantages minority women and limits their access to health care. The unemployment rate for Americans has been at least twice as high as white people, white unemployment for all but 7 years during the 53-year period between 1962 and 2015. And just last month, the unemployment rate for African Americans in this country is at 16.8%. So structural racism is basically the antagonist to the violence that's happening to African Americans in this country. America's judicial system and law enforcement also continues to be an incessant adversary to black people. Since 2005, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, Sandra Boyd, Alton Sterling, Walter Scott, and Eric Garner were just a few that police officers and non-law enforcement agents, Zimmerman, for example, murdered and were exonerated by the judicial system. So they murdered these individuals that I just named and were exonerated. African Americans and other people of color, men, women, and children, continue to face an America of being arrested or murdered for walking, singing, dancing, living in their own homes or apartments, playing with a toy gun, selling CDs, cigarettes, water, or lemonade. Further, they are murdered for wearing a hoodie, sitting in a car with friends, playing music while respecting law enforcement. But now you can add murdered being black and jogging to that list. On February 23rd, Gregory and Travis McMichael killed Ahmaud Arbery, an African-American jogger, in the Santilla Shores of Brunswick, Georgia. After 2 months, finally, the whole world was able to view the video of this young man being murdered by father and son. The men were finally arrested this week, May 7th. The case will go to a grand jury, but only after Georgia ends the statewide judicial emergency, which is currently in effect until June 12th. The two-month delay is a failure of our justice system once again, but even more so because if the case's outcome is legitimately uncertain, Georgia's laws allow open carry, citizen's arrest, and lethal force in self-defense. Now, this is what we're having is stand your ground, open carry, and lethal force in defense. So if everybody that's seen this video realized that this young man was jogging, minding his business. He was not a threat to this father and son. He was not a threat to them at all. But they killed him despite that. That could very well give the McDaniels enough plausible deniability to walk free. See, Georgia laws allow open carry. They allow them to do it. According to that police report, George Gregory Michael suspected that Aubrey Wu was involved in several recent burglaries in the area. Although only one burglary was reported to the police between January 1st of this year and February 23rd. On January 1st, a Smith & Wesson and a 9mm pistol was stolen from the pickup truck at the home of Travis McMichael. Gregory McMichael, a retired investigator, told police that, quote, he saw Aubrey hauling ass down Satilla Drive. In response to seeing a jogger do what joggers typically do, the McMichaels took a .357 Magnum and a shotgun and pursued Aubrey in a white pickup truck. And we know that the video captured by a friend of the McMichaels, a William Bryan, who helped chase down Aubrey, tells the rest of the story to us. The McMichaels cut off Aubrey, and Travis Gregory's son got out of the truck to confront him. They struggled over the shotgun. Travis fired 3 shots, and Aubrey died. He was unarmed, though the McMichaels believe he was because they claimed they saw Aubrey with his hand down his pants the other night, according to the February 23rd police report. So they're talking about something that happened the other night, but not talking about right then when they murdered this young man in cold blood. He had no weapon. He had nothing on him. He had not robbed anybody. He jogged. He enjoyed jogging. And that's all he was doing. Not only did police not make an arrest until the Georgia Bureau of Investigation stepped in, but the first two prosecutors assigned to the case, Jackie Johnson and Gregory L. Barnhill, recused themselves because of professional connections to Gregory McMichael. So this is where the structural racism comes in. They recused themselves, but it gets more sinister. However, Barnhill wrote a letter to the Glenn County Police Department suggesting that the killing was legally justified in accordance with Georgia's open carry and stand your ground law, as well as the state code that a private citizen may arrest a suspect upon reasonable and probable grounds of suspicion if the suspect is attempting to escape. Mr. Aubrey was not planning to escape anywhere. He was minding his business and jogging. So that means that anytime someone down in the South, in Georgia in particular, some racist decides that he doesn't like you, you look suspicious, and he's telling you to halt while he's standing there with a gun, and you say, I've done nothing to no one, and I'm going to continue walking. Basically, he could shoot and kill you and say, hey, I told him to stop. I had probable cause. I had reasonable and probable grounds of suspicion. Of suspicion of what? He looked suspicious. Upon reasonable and probable grounds of suspicion, he looked suspicious, so I shot him and killed him. Give me my medal and let me go about my business. And in Georgia, that's exactly what looks like could happen. The McMichaels will likely try to use these laws as plausible deniability for a killing. Barnhill letter suggests that Aubrey is the aggressor. If you're walking down the street, ladies and gentlemen, and somebody pulls up and a truck jumps out with guns blazing, what do you do? So they're saying, this prosecutor is saying that Mr. Aubrey was the aggressor, as if Mr. Aubrey had saw, he saw these guys in their truck, and he decided to go after them. This is the structural racism that I'm talking about, which leads to the lynchings that's been happening in this country since 1865. This framing is absurd on its face, no matter the merit of the legal technicalities used to justify it. Ahmaud Arbery was chased, corralled, and shot to death by armed men. They escalate the situation at every opportunity. He was innocent in every way. Arbitrary killers walk free due to the web of laws that sanctify killing, then it will prove nothing except that the laws are unjust. Even if the McMichaels do go to prison, the mere possibility that they could legally harass and kill a man or woman or child on mere suspicion of burglary is unacceptable. This harkens back to the days of old where black people were constantly assaulted, accosted, and murdered, lynched, because of suspicion. Think about Tulsa, a thriving black community, thriving. And then the racist hatred that this black community was doing so much better than the white towns surrounding it in that area. They started saying that the black men had fired guns into the white community. There was talk that some black men from Tulsa had raped white women. And they were given carte blanche to go into that black community and kill the people willy-nilly, burn down their shops, rape the women, kill the children and the men, and there was nothing in the United States being done to address it. They said, well, they look suspicious. What do you want us to do? Yet people say in the 21st century, a whole lot has changed. And that may be true. There are a lot of things that have changed. But ladies and gentlemen, when you see things like this, when things like this are happening in our country, at any time in this country, this is horrific. But when we are facing down a pandemic that's infecting millions and killing hundreds of thousands of people, this is a travesty. See, racism and hate does not take a break. Racism and hatred doesn't say, oh, well, we have a pandemic. Let us table our racist hatred towards these group of people or this group of people till we get through this pandemic. It doesn't work like that, ladies and gentlemen. Hatred and racism elevates its game. Because while we're so preoccupied addressing this pandemic that we're dealing with, hatred and racism is going out and doing this to innocent people. This incident happened on February 23rd. It is May 2020. So more than 2 months went by before this came about, before we knew about this. We've come a long way in this country, but oh boy, have we taken so many steps backwards. And these laws in Georgia and in Tennessee, these are the type of laws, structural racism, that will continue to get African Americans and people of color in this country murdered, lynched on a daily basis. If Georgia laws were not as they are, Ahmaud Arbery would likely have lived to see his 26th birthday, which was a couple of days ago. Without citizen's arrest, Gregory and Travis McMichael might not have attempted to detain Arbery. Without open carry, they might not have brought a Magnum 357 and a shotgun. Without stand your ground, they might have thought twice before shooting. Racism is alive and well in this country. Hatred still has a place in this country. Hate and racism is as American as apple pie. And we continue to fail to defeat it because we're not willing to change policy that's been in place for a very long time. Structural racism destroys a nation. Not overnight. It takes a good long while, but it does. It erodes it. And here we are in 2020 dealing with a pandemic and hatred at epic proportions. I end the show this evening with "We Can Be the Outcome." As a child, my parents explained to me and my siblings that beyond the community where we live, 30th and Lehigh, there was a real world outside of that community, a world where cruelty, racism, and hate rules. So they prepared us. Still, they knew that their children would experience racism firsthand, so preparing us was essential. It didn't take long before I came face to face with racism, hate, and the stereotypical views of a young black boy. 1984, four black youths in the eighth grade were coming home one rainy night on Roosevelt Boulevard, and we were stopped by two police officers. The police officers jumped out of their car with guns pointing at the young men, and they said, quote, "Don't move." They lined the young men up, and shortly after, they removed a white woman from the back of the squad car. She's crying and completely distraught. The police officer asked her, "Was it them?" She looked at them closely, intensely, and angrily. Then she said, "No, it's not them. They didn't rob me." One of the police officers got agitated and said, "Look at them again and take your time." She turned to the police officer angrily and yelled, "It's not them. They did not rob me." He tells her to look again, but instead she returned to the squad car. The police officer looked at me and my three friends. He wanted to hurt us. The look of disappointment on his face that we were not the ones that robbed that woman told the entire story. He angrily said to us, "Get your asses home." They say, ladies and gentlemen, that time heals all wounds. I'm 51 years old. The wounds haven't healed. Good night.